that I know you'll know, and I'll start with one that I know you know, is Alfred Minders.
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 You pronounce it Minders, M-Y, mine, mine was the editor of the newspaper here, editor of the editorial page of the Chattanooga Times.
From about when?
Well, I don't know when he started here. He was on the job when I got here. He was the editor then, and he was a very lovely man, a good writer, and a very kindly disposed, rather shy person. He wasn't any forthright spoke person that went out and spoke and delivered. He was a very shy person.
Was he the editor or the editorial page editor?
He's the editor of the editorial page. That's the way we divide it here all the time.
Yeah.
Between the managing editor in charge of the news,
right,
the editor in charge of the editorial page, and the publisher in charge of the whole thing. And then you have a business manager who handles strict business type. And he also comes under them. He was a very shy, soft-spoken man, very modest. My recollection is he came from, his father had been, I think his father had been the superintendent of schools in the state of Tennessee. He came from Nashville.
He did?
In my recollection, he came from Nashville. His father had been the superintendent of schools.
Was he Jewish?
Oh, no, 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 an old-line Protestant family.
Like what, Presbyterian? Episcopalian? You wouldn't know.
He might have been more like most men at that time, rather, you know, withdrawn from any strong... He didn't affiliate himself with any church in any great measure that I know of. And his father, I think, had been maybe the first state superintendent of school, something like that. I used to have a file on him here, maybe. And he was had a very good relationship with Cardinal Stritch.
Who was from Nashville.
Who had been an altar boy in Nashville and grew up in Nashville and became the cardinal in Chicago.
Right.
And was very liberal in his outlook in his time, particularly with the Chicago background. And it was Alfred Minders to whom Cardinal Stritch would send a check every year for Southern Regional Council, like $1,000 that he'd send it to Alfred, and Alfred would take it to them. He was the one they transmitted the money through.
He laundered.
Out of his regard for his father, he had known Alfred's father.
He laundered it for him.
In a sense, he could have laundered it, yes. But he sent it. He may have sent it sometime, but I know that Alfred did take it there on some occasions and was in touch with him about the South as it was evolving right after the war there in that period, you know. And he was familiar with the South as a child, and so he always counted on Alfred to be one of the sources he wanted for information. Where did he stand? What are they doing? He had a nice phone recognition with him, you know, telephone, and that was about that. He was, I say, a very quiet man, and he made no show of himself. He was not one of these show-off editors, and I don't mean that in the wrong way either. He just wasn't given to that sort of for himself.
Who was the managing editor at that time?
Well, when I came here, I think Jimmy Jarvis had just become the managing editor right after the war. James Jarvis.
And how long did he stay in that job?
Well, let's see.
He
stayed until I became what they call, they didn't call it managing editor, they call it general managing editor or something, because I was to be over him. They didn't want to take his title from him.
I see.
They made me general managing editor, and then he stayed there for a few more years until he died, or an early death.
Was Minders still here when you came?
Oh, Minders was here when I came.
And stayed how long?
Oh, I can't tell you when that was. It doesn't come back to me how long.
Into
Minders
the 50s?
Here. Well, I would think so. I didn't take that job until about 1958, so it might have been in the 50s. I know he was here all, well, it had to be there.
Yeah.
I didn't come here till 47,
right,
so he had to be through the 50s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A very lovely man, very warm to dispose, a very beautiful writer. Everybody had a great feeling for his style. He was a lovely writer. And he took in his day what were strong positions.
He was a liberal.
On civil rights.
Yeah.
Very strong on civil rights, even though he came from Middle Tennessee. And his father had been, as I say, my recollection was a state school superintendent, I think it was.
This might have been the most liberal newspaper editorially in the South at that time.
Well, it was in that period in some years following. I don't think there's any question. And Mark Knox took his place, you know. And so through that period, we never departed from the cause of civil rights as it evolved. From all the court, not only the 54 big decision, but all the succeeding decisions and how you expand, how you enrich, we supported all of it. A good many papers ran when it got to that close.
Right.
I would say you could generally say that there were about four papers that never departed from the idea that civil rights is, you know, total. That would have been the Chattanooga Times, and I'll add one, which is the Courier Journal in Louisville. It didn't really have a challenge up there,
yeah,
but they did it. And then, of course, the Nashville Tennessean was very good, Coleman Harwell and all that crowd, and then you had the Arkansas Gazette with Harry Ashmore. Those four papers never departed from what was right.
You don't include the Constitution in that, do you?
Yeah, the Constitution wavered some, you know, and... there always was a story around.
Likewise, the
McGill was just a little too liberal for him in those periods, and so they sent him on a tour, was the story, or he made a number of visits abroad to avoid him writing on that subject.
You don't include Riley, Jonathan Daniels' paper.
I'm not in a position to go on. I just know those are the ones we talked about, Jonathan Daniels, but I'm not sure that the paper stayed that wholesome all the way. They may have wavered some. They had some problems over there, you know, in their eastern North Carolina. When I say that, didn't mean that they didn't always say, I'm with this development, but they were never total that way. They would pull back at certain times. I don't mean they ever departed.
Right. Minders articulated that policy. He shaped that policy,
yes,
as much as anything.
He gave a great deal to it, because at that time Mr. Puckett was here as the general manager and ran the paper as an absentee of a publisher. And the publisher, of course, was Mr. Ike's brother, you know.
Yeah.
Adolf. Or not Adolf.
Adolf's brother.
What's his name? It's Colonel Locke. General Ox. God, I'm forgetting. He was the publisher that sat out the time. I came. No, that's Arthur. He's Salzburg. Yeah. This is Milton's brother would have been, I guess. Locke's brother, I can't think. You know, I knew him, my God. I saw him overseas during the war.
But in any case,
he's an army officer.
He was not here, though.
No, but he would only come in maybe once a year or something, you know.
And then
Mr.
Puckett.
Mr. Puckett was a former old Tennessee family who had gone to Sewanee, was an outstanding graduate up there, and descended from one of the founding families at Sewanee. He has a son who's a very prominent science teacher up there, Stephen Puckett. And Mr. Puckett went into the newspaper business. I don't know where he got started, but he ended up in New York. On the New York Times, I used to see him there when I was a reporter.
Yeah.
And he became a sort of a guide or a mentor or something of that sort for Arthur Hayes Sulzberger. The story at the time was that Mr. Ox had not made up his mind who was going to be his successor up there. The son-in-law, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, or Colonel Ox. And he never made, you know, any direct choice in it. Mr. Puckett was the one who groomed and worked and that, so it was very close to him. He never forgot that.
Yeah.
And so Mr. Puckett came here after the war to represent the paper's control and the publisher and that sort of thing, even though he was not publisher. He was a general manager, I guess you would have called him at the time. And Mr. Puckett stayed here in those days. And what was I answering? What was the
question? Yeah, I was just trying to get a lineup of the people.
Yeah, well, Mr. Puckett came from a very distinguished family here in Tennessee and a direct descendant of one of the founders of of that, and Stephen Puckett as his son up there, and that sort of thing. So it had wonderful ties to the old Episcopal church structure.
And
was a very kindly disposed man, very nice man. And Ray Howe married his daughter. Ray Howe became an editorial assistant here. Married his daughter, who's still living up at Sawatty.
There was a columnist, I think syndicated columnist, named Thomas Stokes.
Oh, Tom Stokes. I knew Tom very well.
Where was he from?
My recollection is from Savannah, Georgia. Pretty sure Savannah.
Where was he based as a
columnist? Out of Washington.
Washington?
Well, I used to see him at the presidential conventions, nominating conventions.
Are you quite sure he was a Southerner?
Oh, Tom Stokes? Yeah. Oh, yes, definitely.
He's not still living, is he?
Oh, no, he's dead for some time.
Likewise, Manders is not.
No, Manders
been
is
dead
dead,
a long
that's
time.
Right.
Tom Stokes wrote a fairly liberal column.
That's right. For his time, he wrote a liberal column and was identified as a Southerner with his view, you know.
Yeah.
But he lived most of his adult life and all the years of his fame in Washington and nationally. He roamed around the country and worked out of Washington. Very nice, pleasant fellow, Tom Stokes.
Okay. Henry Lassane.
Hmm?
Henry Lassane. L-E-S-E-S-N-E, from Charleston. You remember him?
Henry Lassane. I didn't know him, no.
He may have,
but he doesn't come to my mind. I certainly didn't know him well enough to retain him as an image.
He wrote for the Herald Tribune, and he was from Charleston. And he liked to
He was a correspondent for the New York Herald Tribune.
He liked to come back down south and write these long things.
I have a recollection that there was someone like that. I didn't know him. There was right. That's right. That was a man.
What about Thomas Sancton? S-A-N-C-T-O-N. Sancton.
Thomas Stanton?
Sancton.
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 S-A-N-T-O-N.
S-A-N-C-T-O-N.
S-A-N-C.
T-O-N.
Sanctum, Tom Sanctum. No, I don't place him.
He was from either New Orleans or Jackson, and he ended up as an editor at the New Republic.
Oh, Tom Sanctum. I remember vaguely there was, but I didn't know him, no.
What was the managing editor of the New York Times' name from Louisiana?
Turner Catlett, you mean?
Catlett.
He was from Mississippi.
From Mississippi.
Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Yeah.
He's the one that assigned me here.
Yeah. He was at Memphis for a while, wasn't he?
He was in the Memphis Commercial Appeal. He began his career right there, really.
And when did he go to the Times? Do you know when he went up to the Times?
Well, he went to right after, well, let me give you a story. My recollection is that we had the famous flood in 1927, and Herbert Hoover wanted to be, or he was designated as a candidate for the presidency. If he hadn't been, at least they put him in charge of the flood survey. He came down and went all over the Mississippi, one of the great floods in history. He went all over the Mississippi, and Turner Catledge was assigned to him by the Commercial Appeal, young reporter. And he knew everybody in Mississippi country in the day it was. And he would introduce him to everybody and identify him and all that sort of thing, you know. This is the one you want to pay attention, that sort of thing. And Mr. Hoover didn't forget it. He was very gracious to Mr. Hoover. And so the story was when he got back to Washington, one of his supporters was Mr. Patterson, who was in the publisher of the Baltimore Sun. And so he got in touch with Mr. Patterson and said, I'd like to recommend that you hire a very fine young reporter down there in the Commercial Appeal. And so Mr. Patterson brought him to Baltimore as a reporter. He married the landlady's daughter, his first wife there.
Mm-hmm.
And he stayed there for a while. And then Mr. Hoover came in, 28. And Mr. Hoover favored a New York Herald Tribune reporter, I forgot his name, he's very famous in those days, Washington man, and the Baltimore Sun, and their bureaus and all, getting all kinds of news. story. And Cattledge, of course, said, you know, send me over there, you know, or at least I think he was over there, but he went over for the Baltimore Sun in order to have the contact with the White House. And when the word got out that he had the contact, the Times took him.
I see.
So he went to the Times somewhere like 1928.
I see.
29, right in there.
Yeah.
And at that time, he was with him for a few years, and then when the New Deal came in, the most famous reporting on the New Deal was by Turner Catledge and, oh God, my old friend, old Washington family. Oh God, I can't think of his name, but the two of them wrote the great stories, and, you know, the famous 100 Days and all the letter agencies,
right,
and everything. And Turner was the great, every Monday morning for months, the New York Times would have a lead story on what the hell a New Deal was about, what it meant, how to interpret it, even Wall Street, everybody else had to find out, on the gold standard, off, whatever it was. Came very famous as a reporter. He became a national reporter, roamed all over the country as a national reporter.
Yeah.
And then in the war, he became very close to Mr. Sulzberger. And Mr. Sulzberger was the head of the Red Cross, the National Red Cross during the war years.
Mm-hmm.
And he went visiting. I saw Sulzberger and Catledge came out to have a lunch at the 3rd Marine Division on Guam when I was there.
Yeah.
I saw them. The general in command was a very close family friend, asked me to come up there to lunch with him. I wouldn't have been there otherwise.
Uh-huh.
I saw them. Oh, yeah, I knew Catledge was a great reporter.
Was that when you first met him?
Met who, Catledge?
Catledge.
Oh, no, I had met him when I was a reporter in New York. Every time there was a national election, either the president or the House in between,
yeah,
two or three people, including him, always came up from Washington to write their version of Congress or what it meant, their interpretation. So I was in the city room for anywhere from 5 to 6, 7 days during that period.
And
we all used to go out at night.
When you got out of the Marine?
When I got out of the Marine Corps, I was assigned to the United Nations. Well, I got back and worked around the desk for a little while. And then they sent me out to the United Nations. Had about 8 of us out there.
Right.
And so during the, near the end of it there, say in January or something like that, I was across the street at a popular bar where the Times people all went, you know, had a few beers after, during hours. And he said, I want to talk to you.
Was he the managing editor at that time?
I think he was assistant managing editor. I think he had not succeeded Edwin L. James yet.
I see.
He was assistant managing editor. He was filling these spots around the country, and he was dying to get one for the South. And he asked me what I tried.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll give it a chance.
That was in early 47, wasn't it?
That was in long about January of 47.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pop, where were you in August of 46?
August 46, I was in China.
You were?
Yeah.
When Hiroshima...
I stayed in China a year after the war, you know.
When Hiroshima was bombed, where were you?
Oh, well, Hiroshima was bombed. I was on Guam in the 3rd Marine Division, which was the lead division to invade Japan. We the ones were mighty happy to see it.
Yeah.
They told us we were only going to last 10 days. That division, they said, only survive 10 days, you'll be pretty well wiped out. You got others moving behind. You get the high ground and hold it.
Glad you didn't have to do that.
Well, I didn't have to do that. That would have been number 10 for me, too.
Yeah. At that time, did you have any thoughts?
Right after that bomb was dropped, a couple of days later, they arranged for me to go to China,
yeah,
with 14 Americans.
Yeah, I remember
all
that.
All of them had lived in China, familiar with it.
Yeah.
And we went out there to Beijing, Pekin,
right,
it was called then.
Right. At that point in your life, let's see, you would have been about 35 years old.
Well, in 1946, I was 36 years,
yeah,
old.
Did you have any vague notion at all in your mind that you might someday go back to the South?
Oh, no, not at all.
Wasn't even remotely
not
part of your
mind at all, no. Nobody'd ever had any assignment like that, so it wasn't on my mind. I didn't have anything to say, well, I'd like to get that.
Yeah.
All we did was have people in the South who would be correspondents and write pieces largely for the Sunday department, little summaries of news, and that's
right,
what you had. Well, once in a while, a reporter might go through for a week or two. particularly if it was some sort of a climatic thing had taken place, you know, some recent sort of things of that sort.
Right. Okay, I want to ask you about another person, George Fort Milton.
Now, I didn't know George Fort Milton. He wasn't living when I got here. If he was, he died later. He'd been quite a figure in this town, you know.
What of his reputation lingered for you to acknowledge?
Well, the only thing I ever knew that he was, you know, very much of a liberal here in Chattanooga.
He had that reputation.
He had that reputation, and he started his own paper here. And
News.
It might have been the News or the News Free Press.
No, it was the News.
The News, and then the Free Press got it.
Right.
And he was quite an historian, too. I mean, a respected historian.
Yeah.
And my recollection of it, Chandler at the time did not support TVA, you know, when he came in. And he did. He was a great promoter of TVA.
So at that time...
He was at odds with the Times on TVA.
In the early to mid-30s, that paper was to the left of the Times.
That's right. That's right. It was to the left of the Times.
It didn't stay there, though.
He didn't remain. Oh, right. No. That was too... You couldn't sustain that here for any long haul. No, you had some labor over here in East Tennessee, as you know. You had the mountain people and that sort of thing, and labor activities, you know, and that had some sentiment, but it couldn't compare with the other.
Okay. Another person, Charles S. Johnson.
You mean the president of Fisk? Oh, I knew him quite well. I wish I had a letter with me that he wrote me one time. I'll get a copy of it for you.
What does it say?
Oh, he just said, I've been talking to you now, just how great I was, what I had meant to his life, what I meant to the black people in this community.
Yeah.
I knew Charlie Johnson was the American delegate to UNESCO.
Is that when you first met him?
No, I first met him up at Fisk. He was a UNESCO delegate. He was an outstanding sociologist, highly esteemed, a very lovely person. And they had what they call a race relations institute that they had started up at Fisk University.
He started it.
That's right. And it ran about a week and 10 days, that whole period. And I heard about it. And so I went up, and I stayed the whole period. I went up every year for 15 years. Even a couple of years after I stayed here, I always went up for it. So rich.
Yeah.
So wonderful for someone who cares. Wonderful speakers from all over the country, outstanding people, you know. And long talks, Charlie Johnson would be presiding in a large measure. Other associates he had up there that were very wonderful. Now, I don't want to be, you know, think about this, so I love it. I'm the only one that ever went there and stayed. Nobody else ever did.
Right.
General rule, they followed the Southern pattern, and that is, if they opened, they gave them an opening story. They might have one well-known national speaker that might come up for that, and that's all. I stayed there the whole damn 10, 12, 14 days. Didn't have to file a story, didn't mean a thing. I told Turner, I said, this is where you get it. What filters through a man's mind? What makes him function how he is? This is what's being laid on the table. The way they're responding in this college community. And I found well-run friendships with his faculty, outstanding people that I knew, you know. One of them, his daughter's working for the Atlanta Constitution.
She is?
Yeah, and I think his son is a lawyer for them down there in Atlanta.
Oh.
But in any event, no, that would be Charlie Johnson's boy, I guess, is the lawyer for the other one. But in any event, I went there always for 15 years.
And
I never missed it.
You knew
and
him.
And I sat all morning, all afternoon, all night, bull sessions, long talks, into night dinner, the way you're supposed to find the people. The way you're supposed to find them and live with them and care. They'd never had anybody do this to them before. And there I was, and the New York Times was the magic. There I am at the dinner table, there I'm over the house at night, here I am on the campus, and always for 15 damn years. I don't know what the hell, I wrote something about Charlie, maybe one of these Name in the News or something of that sort. I have a beautiful love for him if I can find it.
Yeah.
But she says, I just can't repay you for what you've done for the black people in the South. And I always know now. They received a Phi Beta Kappa chapter up there. And the only schools in the state of Tennessee that had it, no state universities, only Vanderbilt, Sovani, and Southwestern Roads, they call it now. That's the only three that you had in the state. And they got to find me the capital chapter. And he called me, and he told me, and he was having a big meeting like the next day. And he was having one of the big multi-millionaires that put up all kinds of funds for them up there. Horse racing family, I can't think of their name. Very noted society family. Big horse racing people in one side.
Uh-huh.
But he said, I need some help. He said, I don't want to offend anybody. I want to say it in some way that we're so thankful in what it means. He said, I have friends all over here in the educational community. And I went up there and sat down, helped him write that thing. You know, it will give him, you know, words and approach. It would be understanding and broad-based. Now we all possess. I did that for that man.
Did you socialize with him any?
In what way? Out at the school all the time.
I mean, in the evenings.
He'd be over for dinner. We'd all sit around and talk at night.
Situations where
and
you kind of let your hair
down. He spoke
down.
To the Southern Baptist convention one time. And what's his name was the former congressman we all like so much from Oakland, Arkansas.
Brooks Hayes.
He and Brooks Hayes. Yeah, Brooks, I think, was the president for about 2 years.
That's right.
And Brooks had him there speak that day. I was there that day. When I was in Louisville when he died. He died of a heart attack on a railroad station, and I didn't know it. I was on my way home when he died.
In Louisville?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. He died in a railroad depot in Louisville.
You knew him really well, didn't you?
I knew him very well. I certainly did in his day.
He was in a very difficult position. He had influence among blacks, and he had influence among whites.
Mm-hmm.
He was a man in the middle.
That's right.
He was a diplomat.
That's right.
And he wanted to bring the South to a position of equality for all people.
That's right.
The language of the Constitution he wanted to make real.
That's precisely right.
And
he had a very gentle, sweet way about him, too. He's a lot in the South in those days.
Yeah. I'm surprised that there's not more written about him. You know, there's no biography, there's no...
Well, because you had a large number of white newspaper people and various others who just paid no attention to him all those years, and I guess they never...
They took him for granted.
They took it for granted. You know, one of the little techniques he would use, I remember when Bill Gray was president down at Florida A&M and a few like that, you know, and they were so good at it. Oversimplified, but let's say that... Well, a writer, you know, the big people that make some broad announcements and scare the hell out of the whites. So immediately they go to the governor, you know, the state legislature, you know, don't worry about this. I'm going, you know, we're going to help him. You know, can you put a bill in and give us an increase in our buildings for our sociology, our chemistry, and this and that? We'll keep everything quiet, you know, that's the way you play for governor of the legislature. It was smooth. And I understood what they were doing. I never blew the whistle on.
Yeah.
I knew they were doing it.
Did you think...
I'm the only white newspaper man, you know, out of the New York Times or the rest of the South that had any relationship to them with me.
Yeah.
Well, McGill, of course, was very popular with them, and some educators, you know.
Yeah.
Howard Oldham, people of that sort, you know, that they knew, but they didn't have any other reporter that had ever done this.
Yeah.
I stayed with them wherever they were.
Benjamin Mays was another one.
Benjamin Mays, very well. I introduced him here one time when he came up to make a talk, yeah.
There was that small group of black leaders.
That's right.
Mostly in academia.
Mostly academics, and usually with degrees, graduate degrees from outstanding schools.
Right. Harvard,
South,
Chicago.
That you couldn't get them here.
Right.
That's right. They went to the best of schools.
Yeah.
That's so true, you know. Well, still you got all the white people and half of them the black. Think of M.L. King as just another black preacher. Well, he's got a doctor's degree in theology from Boston University, one of the best theological schools.
Right.
Very learned man.
Yeah.
But he had to play his game.
Yeah. did you ever think during those years, the late 40s and early 50s, before the civil rights movement started, that...
Well, now, the civil rights movement really started in 48, you know.
Yeah, right. But I think of the Brown decision as being sort of...
54. You started prior to 54, let's say.
Prior to 54. You saw men like Charles Johnson and Benjamin Mays and a handful of others trying to get the South to do itself what seemed inevitable if down the road. I mean, a long time before Brown came down, anybody who was thinking about it knew there was going to be a Brown.
Some reaction, one of us met the book in the hotel and wrote a book again,
yeah,
you know.
Right. So, looking back on that, people like Charles Johnson and Benjamin Mays seem like really important people, very prophetic. They knew what needed to be done. They would tell you in private, but they were caught in the middle arena.
Well, of course, and the guy that's helping us over some time, Governor A is helping them, you know. They can't blow the whistle on Governor A.
Yeah.
They got to protect him. No, I don't know anything about it, you know. See, what if you came over and said, this is what we'll do, and I know that Governor A, you ruin him with the voters. You have to be so careful. It's a Hodges plan, essentially, in North Carolina.
Yeah.
You know, all over the state. They had it with Clement and Ellington here in Tennessee and all.
Yeah.
Well, how the hell do you've got to bail them out. You've got to make sure that you take care of the intransigent, you know, and the wildlife. And so you offer them a little piece of legislative bullshit, you know.
Yeah.
Say a few words at the right place, huh? And then you've got two senators here, the two outstanding in the whole damn South, and that period will keep off and go. And the only damn two senators in the South that wouldn't sign the Southern Manifesto.
Yeah. Yeah.
They knew they could get away with it here.
Did things move as fast as you think they could have, as you look back on it?
Oh, I think they moved about as fast as they could have, yes. And when you consider the roadblocks, the handicaps, the potholes,
yeah,
they didn't do bad at all.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you say it as a smooth thing, you wonder what the hell took you so long. But open a lot of goddamn traps out there.
Yeah.
And a man's got to survive.
Yeah. Let's talk about Hiding Carter and Ralph McGill for a minute. Take Carter first. He was from Louisiana, from Mississippi.
Louisiana.
Mississippi and Louisiana.
Yeah, from Louisiana, and he married his wife, is from New Orleans,
old
piano firm down there, very noted player piano firm in Broad Street, very noted place. And then he ended up in that paper in Greenville, Mississippi.
Yeah.
And a very chum. He'd been educated up east, you know.
He'd written,
I think it was.
Written several books. He was an accomplished...
I introduced him to Macaulay School out here about as early as 1948, 49.
Uh-huh.
I don't know who they were. Miners is the one that said, you know him. Well, you introduce him if he comes over here.
Yeah.
And how the hell I got set up, but he did.
Yeah.
And I used to visit with him from time to time in Greenville. He and his wife.
Yeah.
The boy was growing up, you know, he was
a,
he went to one of the prep schools up east, I forget which one, and he went to Princeton.
Yeah.
And he was a reserve officer in the Marine Corps, did a couple of years in the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. I used to see him in those days, you know, when he was a kid around the house. Hiding was a delightful person, full of wonderful humor, you know, great storyteller.
Yeah.
And great originator of all kinds of little poetry, you know. Quite a guy. Everybody liked him.
He never hung out with the McGill crowd, did he?
He never what?
Didn't hang out with this crowd of guys, McGill.
No, he didn't come over to Atlanta and hang out. You know, the South structured and then Atlanta was out of center.
Yeah.
But he had a very close friend in Ashmore. Now, he and Ashmore were very close.
Yeah.
And Ashmore is out there in Little Rock, and he's over where he is, so they had a fraternity. And he knew a lot of people up east, and he was another one of those, when you divided the South that way, between his background and New Orleans, his identity up east, you know, his name emerged as a national spokesman. And so people from the rest of the country would come and see him,
yeah,
and you know, and get filled in on the South. Then you came to Atlanta and you saw McGill and you saw Hal Fleming at the Southern Regional Council, if you had any damn sense, you know. And then, of course, you went to see V. Dabney. He was still a pretty good name, you know, in Richmond.
Yeah.
And then there'd be a few little, you pick up a little work, try this one, try that one. Well, of course, Pete, what's his name?
McKnight.
I love Pete McKnight. Always went to see him. We had somebody in every state, you know.
You remember an incident in 1948. There was a reporter, a white reporter for the black paper in Pittsburgh, made a trip through the South
and
wrote some articles.
That's right,
Ashmore and Hiding Carter went on the road to debate this guy.
That's right.
You remember that?
I remember that.
Can you tell me anything about that?
No, I just read about it. I didn't cover it or anything.
They
were on the hot, you know,
went on the radio and whatnot, and
I didn't see my covering it South that way. I don't say anything. I was busy doing a lot of other things. You got to know who the people that filter things. Who was the man? You know, where do you find them? Who are they? How much time do you spend with them? You know, come on here. I go over to North Carolina and sit up and talk for hours with Howard Odom, the greatest sociologist in the South and maybe the best in the United States in his day. Two or three of his associates over there. Publisher used to put out a damn little report every few months, every quarter. Marvelous little insight. I can't think of the guy that was his successor.
Rupert Vance.
Rupert Vance, that's it. Rupert Vance, wonderful little guy, bright as hell. He had two other guys used to write these reviews with him, Hoover and something else. One guy's name was Hoover, and I forget what the other guy's name was, Roper or something like that. I used to get those names. I would get those things, you understand, and get them in the mail, and then I'd sit down and I'd call them on the phone and add a little, and I'd make a story. I'd make a story. Nobody else ever touched it. I made a story out of it. I spent my time doing that, you understand? I got them in the New York Times, in a Sunday paper, way big Sunday paper, particularly, you know, dying for stories, filling those damn pages full of sets. Well, there were national attention. Somebody wrote them a letter. Somebody read. Somebody said, my God, I saw him in the New York Times the other day. You understand how you work with those people? What they find, what opens up to them? Some university, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, NYU, something, I get in touch with them. Good word, who are you, others? And they become a voice for me. They become a special voice for me. That's why I sit in Fisk for 15 goddamn days, for 12, 15 years, you understand? That's why, for example, if you have a National Congress, you know, Recreation Congress, meet in New Orleans, all over the South, you know, the National Congress, they meet in New Orleans, last for a week. One story's all it's worth, that they're meeting there. I stay there for the whole 7 days. I go to breakfast, I go to lunch, I go to dinner, I move, I talk and move with them all the time. Every damn one of them is going to be a key person on a community. I know that much about the South. People outside don't know that. And I know what they do when they run the playgrounds and the recreation centers or they're in a grade school in this now. There wasn't a town in the South that I couldn't go into and find one of them. So hell, fuck, you know, what's going on? Well, my people are talking to me, they, you know, I don't think they care that damn much. I'm looking out for their kids. They explain to you where we're going. You know, that kind of reporting is what I would do. I don't worry about who the hell is on the TV.
Yeah.
Or who the hell is going to be on the radio. I know I read it, but there is no answer there for me. I don't need that.
Yeah.
I can read the damn paper. What I've got to know is what the hell is filtering through the minds of the people with sensitivity and that care. And you have to work every damn day, 24 hours a day for years until you did it.
Yeah.
And then I also caught, because Sitton was a hell of a good reporter. They caught that great clash, you understand. But I also, and he didn't have time, I'm sure he could have done it if he only did it 6 years. But I also had to take on everything else. Education as such as mine. Right. All the manufacturing, all the great change in the economy. All the meaning of what the farm means, how it goes, I stopped my car, I drove all over. I just deliberately go on my way to an agricultural station and spend a half a day out there with a man. What are you doing? How are you changing your crop? But, you know, what's going to fill me in on this damn thing? And I'd say to so many key people, and you know them as well as I do, always, you know, very lovely little academics who are making a talk somewhere. And so it didn't get in the paper. You and me on a Saturday, nobody ever covers it. Mail it to me. I look at it, I can find the lead I want is in paragraph 8. I call him and say, look, give me a little more on this. Move it up, I'll get him. New York Times. New York Times. You know what it meant to them in those days? What it meant to them, what the sources were, and then what they become to me, and then what they begin to tell me of total confidence.
Yeah.
Huh? I had people call me from Alabama, I had a black woman who was an English teacher, and she said, this is after the Alabama incident, you know, and she said, I have a group of people that will be meeting here in a couple of days. These are young students, and she said they're from the high-rise background. Well, I used to know high-rise when I was a boy in school. Most every kid got a high-rise kid. And she said, I have a lot of YMCA-associated people that are sensitive. And there's a lot of talk about this because they don't really have a Christian answer. They're searching. They're sensitive. I should tell a group of those kids, I understand that. We trust you. We don't want any story. I want you to look at it, though. I said, thank you. I went down and spent 2.5 days just sitting there. Listen to these kids getting up. And some of them, of course, from out of the South, you know, with the YMCA ties. Searching, refining, looking for language, don't know what the hell they're talking about half the time, or maybe they do. That's the way you make a report of.
Yeah.
In my book.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about McGill for a few minutes.
Oh, no, yeah, I knew Rob well, you know, I'm a very close friend of my wife and her family.
This is the impression I get from reading McGill and reading about McGill. When he came to the Constitution in the late 30s, he was
a sports writer,
and he moved up to kind of a managing editor job, and then he began to write an editorial page column, ran on the editorial page, right next to the editorials, every day, at least 5 days a week.
About five, I guess it was, in those days, yeah. That's back before the war.
Yeah. If you read through that, you get an impression of a man who was basically a decent man who felt that the people of the South whom he loved, white and black, were decent people, that they meant well, that it was sort of a tragedy what they had thrust upon them, and that they wanted to do what was right.
Mm-hmm. And it was a type of Southern conscience.
You get out
around the place. We know them all.
You don't crowd them too much. Yeah. Give them time, give them room, they'll work this out.
We know them by the scores. They even exist today.
As time went on, other people in the South, including a great many newspaper people, including Minders and Jonathan Daniels and others went out ahead of Ralph McGill on the whole race thing. They were taking positions more liberal than the positions that he was willing to take.
Well, of course, he's writing for his paper, too.
Yeah. And finally, it came down to the Southern Regional Council, and there were meetings behind the scenes to set the stage for this new organization. A group of blacks met over here, group of whites met over here, then delegations from both came together and met, first in Durham, then in Atlanta, then in Richmond.
That's the story. That's
and Ralph McGill was involved in that. But by the time it came back around, he disappeared. And he was not in any way involved with SRC from 1944 when it was founded. His name was on the incorporation papers, but he never joined. He never took an office. He never showed up at meetings anymore. He kind of disappeared. Manders, B. Dabney, Several other journalists got actively involved in SRC. They participated in it. Others, like Jonathan Daniels, never did. Ashmore didn't.
Well, Ashmore wasn't in any position then.
Right, that's right.
Ashmore didn't emerge on the scene until he got up to Little Rock.
That's right. So he's not a good example. But there were some who did and some who didn't.
Right, that's
McGill
right.
was one of those who did not.
Well, so much depends on who you're working for.
Yeah.
If you're working